a long coat over her shoulders and took a lantern from the wall. Geared for travel, she trudged toward the front room. Broken glass tinkled under her steps. Her lantern faded into the night.
"There's nothing more to keep us here," Denny said. "Anyway, the longer we stick around, the more likely our fleet is to attack the wrong house."
A couple of his men chuckled. Some of them bore bandaged cuts, but none had suffered serious injury. Min had a gouge to the left side of her ribs and another on her left triceps, but appeared to have it under control. Blaze lent her a hand outside while Denny saw to Cal and Jinsen oversaw the troops. They hiked to the path on the ridge and followed it to the pier where they tied up the sloop. Once they were on the water, they flashed their lanterns at the lurking cutter, and both boats sailed for home. Denny found Blaze in the bow, cleaning his swords.
"If I gauge you right, you'd be insulted if I offered you money for your help," Denny said. "But I owe you more than I own."
"You've misjudged me completely," Blaze said. "I'm happy to take your money. This time I might even need it."
"Going on a trip?"
"I think so. Don't suppose you know an all-night stable in town?"
"Afraid not."
Denny scratched his goatee.
"But I can have a horse for you first thing in the morning."
Blaze figured he could use the sleep anyway. The boats docked at Denny's pier, and Blaze helped unload the few supplies they'd brought for the raid. Denny saw Cal inside. Once Blaze finished, he stood on the dock watching the moon on the water.
"Uncle Denny made it sound like you're leaving," Min said.
He gave her the eye.
"After a night like tonight, it's not prudent to startle the guy with the swords."
"Is he right?"
"I'm afraid my travels have been extended." Blaze slicked back his grimy hair. "It's time for me to pay homage to the king."
Chapter 25. There ensued an incredulous silence.
"He's going to attack Narashtovic?" Dante laughed.
"Using what? The Eagle King and his faithful legions?
He could never get an army close to the Wodans."
"Unless," Somber said.
Dante sobered abruptly.
"He couldn't."
"Oh, no," Lou said. "Is that why you want Selen?"
"It fits," Somber said. "If it's as powerful as everyone believes, the mountains won't be an obstacle."
Dante flapped his hands.
"What could he possibly want with Narashtovic?"
"The letters are opaque as to his motivations."
"For that matter, how did you manage to crack them? I thought you'd barely made any progress."
"I hadn't," Somber said. "So when Casey took her people to their ill-fated ambush, I broke into their house and stole their translations."
"What do they say about Narashtovic?"
"They refer to the target city as the City of Nine Fragments, an archaic reference to the city's war-torn history."
"Narashtovic is built on a plain," Dante said. "That could be why the minister is drilling his troops in the lowlands."
"Even so, why us?"
"There's more." Somber passed him a decoded letter.
"This details their involvement in Ellen."
"It consists of two parts. First, procuring material. Second, hiring teams of merchants, specifically those with experience dealing with Tev, Kirkit, and beyond."
He raised his eyebrows significantly, receiving a chorus of blank looks in reply.
"People, in other words, with great skill at transporting goods over long and treacherous routes."
C gazed westward.
"Sounds like we ought to head back to Call and pluck his head like a lawbill."
"We're only a few days out from Morive," Dante said. "Horace thought it was important we go there. I say we take a look around, then return to Call."
"First we go to our haunted ruins, then we hightail it for a land we're banished from.
Sounds like a wonderful plan."
"The ruins are haunted?" Lou said. "Of course there's ghosts in ruins," C said.
You should be happy if there's no mummies.
They continued down the path.
Continuing to Moree felt like an odd thing to do, considering they just learned a powerful man, who was possibly crazy, intended to deploy an omnipotent artifact to destroy their homeland for reasons that were not just obscure, but completely unknown.
Part of Dante was in denial, and the part that wasn't in denial was in shock. The moment he came out of it, he intended to loon Nak and explain as best he could, but he needed to wait until he could explain it all. Conveying what they'd learned to Nak took 3 days. Not because Dante procrastinated. He'd looned Nak as soon as he'd eaten dinner that night. Rather because the loons could only be used for an hour per day,
and if they exceeded that limit, they'd break.
Dante had barely begun to fill Nak in when Nak, realizing the gravity of the situation, ran off to find Ollivander. Dante then had to explain things all over again, and since only Nak could hear him, Nak had to repeat it to Ollivander, who often had questions and commentary of his own. Working through everything Dante had seen, heard, and learned took 2.5 full sessions.
"And you find all this credible?" Ollivander asked once he'd concluded.
"I know it sounds like lunacy," Dante said, "but all the pieces fit."
"What type of forces can he muster?"
"The layout of Spiron makes it extremely hard to estimate. When I look at a city, I can guess how many people live there. A forest of titanic trees? No idea."
"We're still recovering from the last war," Ollivander said. "Do you have any idea what time frame he's operating on?"
"If his plans rely on Selen, it all depends on when it manifests. Even if he were to obtain it tomorrow and use it to part a path through the mountains, I can't imagine he'd move before spring."
"He couldn't be planning logistics unless he knows what to expect in Narashtovik. That means he had or has agents here. Any way you can get Somba back home? Use a trebuchet if necessary?"
"He's the one who figured this out," Dante said. "And this can all be averted if I get to Selen first."
"It makes me nervous to have you so far away from the mountains when this minister's prize could show up at any moment. Are you sure you're making the right move?"
"People keep asking that, but the answer doesn't change. I have no god's damn idea. But I think this is the best option."
"I hear you," Ollivander sighed. "I'll begin long-term preparations. Check in whenever there's any developments, no matter how minor, and do not put yourself in harm's way. If the minister gets wind of what you know, he'll execute you on the spot."
Dante wasn't entirely sure how he was supposed to get into Korl and figure out what was going on without putting himself and or his companions in danger, but he let the matter rest.
He was talked out.
Besides, they were almost to Moree. The day before, they had plodded along the path through a line of small, worn mountains. The other side was brown and rocky. The land below was as flat as the prairies of Ellen. But here, the grass grew in lonely yellow clumps. Minty-smelling shrubs rose where they could. Branches humped like the back of an old field hand. Winds rattled across the plain, swirling the dust into tiny, erratic tornadoes. Patches of snow had been hardened into crusty sheets by the unblocked sunlight and the scouring winds. Rodents and small birds picked around for seeds. Twice they saw shepherds tending goats. Small bands of nomads passed by on horseback, dogs barking across the flatlands. For the most part, it was a place of weather and sky. The 6th day after leaving Ellen, they came to a village settled around a large pond. Most of the homes were leather tents, insulated with wool and grass. A few were built from mud bricks. Fences penned in sheep and goats, the posts and rails built from ragged, warped wood that looked like it had been there for centuries. The trail led to the village. Since crossing into the desert, there had been nothing to forage for. Their supplies were growing light. After a quick discussion, they decided to approach the settlement, stopping outside of Bow Range while Dante and Est
went to speak to the locals.
A suntanned and wind-beaten woman met them on the road, the tails of her white braids flapping in the wind.
According to Ast, she spoke first, Wesleyan. He spoke enough to confirm they would be allowed to enter and trade. The tongue was similar enough that Dante could understand it in snatches. He prayed there would be no misunderstandings. Their attempt to barter did not get off to a strong start. Other than their knives and a few metal tools the locals were in short supply of, they had very little to offer. While Dante and Ast haggled over the value of a steel knife, a man brought back his son from the wilds. The young boy's feet were both frostbitten. It took some time for Dante to convince them he could help. In the end, he had to cut his arm, then heal his wound in front of their eyes. A few of the men seemed to think that this was a sign Dante ought to be sunk in the lake, or dragged behind a horse until there was nothing left of him. But the boy's father shouted them down and beckoned Dante into his tent. A few minutes later, the boy's green and red toes had gone pink, their swelling soothed. Dante cautioned the man that he still wasn't sure about one of the toes, but the man kissed him on both cheeks, slaughtered a sheep, and began preparations for a feast of mutton, blood and barley pudding, and fermented milk. Many of the villagers were disinterested, but some 3 dozen others came by over the course of the afternoon and evening, bearing small dishes or skins of beer. They were cautious at first.
Then a young woman shyly showed Dante her rotten tooth.
It was too far gone to save, but with the nefer he was able to push it painlessly from her mouth, her gums healing behind it. With that, the floodgates opened. He, Lou, and even Somber were inundated with requests to heal cuts, infections, aches, and fevers. They couldn't do much for the older people's arthritis, and Dante had to inform one gentleman that even the nether had no solution for baldness. Yet by the end of the feast, they were stuffed, drunk, and gifted with a score of feather charms and bone talismans, along with sacks of barley, dried mutton, and skins of spiced blood the locals claimed would make you as strong as the horses it was harvested from.
"Where are you going?"
the father of the boy asked when things had wound down and the stars blazed from the sky.
"Moreeve," Dante answered. The man frowned. "I would not go there if I were you." "Why? Is it cursed?"
He laughed.
"Of course not. But this is the last village from here until the end of the desert. There is nothing else, nor at Moreeve."
"I hope you're wrong. My home depends on it." Dante asked the others about the place, but while it was nearby, it stood across miles of sandy dunes the villagers rarely spent any time in. Those who'd seen it shrugged, dismissing it as no more interesting than any other hunk of rock in the desert. They were given space to sleep in a stranger's tent. In the morning, they were fed flatbread and farmer's cheese. They took water from the lake and continued south. The baked dirt mingled with sinuous arms of sand. Soon the trail disappeared. Over the course of a couple miles, dunes replaced the plains, rippling north-south as the winds scattered their grains to the east. It was still freezing, but the snows were gone. The loose sand made for slow travel. At the top of each dune, Dante stopped to look in all directions, hunting for anything that looked out of place. With enough height, he could see for miles, but with no road to lead them through the shifting sands, it was possible they'd pass right by the ruins.
As the sun fled west, they began to fear they had.
But miles to the south, a shadow lay on the desert, elongated by the slant of the light. They pushed on. A squared stone tower projected from the sand. They reached it in the last of the light. The stone was a leopard-spotted granite, patterned with black rings enclosing a heterogeneous mash of orange minerals. It was some 50 feet tall, and its walls were 100 feet wide. Friezes and glyphs were etched in the rock.
Those on the western face were worn smooth by years of wind-driven sand.
Dante wanted nothing more than to investigate then and there, but they'd already pushed too far. If they didn't put together some sort of shelter, they might freeze. They moved to the shelter of the east wall and set up their tents. He feared the sand would provide no purchase for their stakes, but the ground right next to the tower was hard-packed, practically stone. Not long after the sun was down, the wind settled as well. They were left in silence, broken only by their own breathing and the shuffling of their ponies. The stillness was so complete, Dante could believe nothing had ever lived here at all, that the tower had been dragged out here by a crazed king who fancied himself an architectural critic. Dante woke multiple times during the night, but he was so tired and sore that despite his excitement, an excitement very much like the kind he'd had as a child waiting for Falmouc's Eve, he was able to stay beneath his blankets until dawn. Once he was up, he ate quickly, then made a circuit around the Tower of Moreave. Except for the occasional patch of glyphs or wind-weathered carving, the walls were blank. There was no sign of a staircase. There were, however, multiple windows on each side, including a few that could be reached from the ground. He returned to the camp and explained he was going inside. To Dante's total lack of surprise, Lou offered to stay outside and copy the glyphs on the walls and attempt to translate them using the speech of the lost. As always, C wanted to join the more active part of the mission. Somber's curiosity led him to volunteer as well. Ast preferred to stay outside and keep watch, but said that Dante should call him up if he encountered anything strange. Dante took C and Somber back to the window. The tower was obviously long dead, but he wished he had a rat to send in first. Even a moth would do. Lacking scouts other than himself, he jumped up, grabbed onto the stone still, and hauled himself inside. Dust motes twirled in shafts of light. Sand sprawled across the floor. The room was otherwise bare stone. He gestured to the others and lowered himself to the floor. It smelled like dust, but there was no hint of mustiness. The other two climbed in behind him, landing on the floor with a burst of sand. The rest of the rooms were as empty as the first, but they found a stairwell, hard-packed sand, cementing the steps into a ramp. They stomped their feet through the crust and headed upstairs. The sand on the second level drifted against the walls, but there was less of it, with stone showing in the middle of the floor. Shrunken piles of what might have been curtains were crumpled beneath the windows. When Dante touched one, it crumbled to ashy remnants. A metal bar lay on the ground, pitted and green with age. Loose timber sprawled around the room, but it was so chewed up and rotten that it was hard to identify what it might once have been. The next three floors presented similar results. The rooms weren't empty, but they may as well have been. The higher they got, the less sand rested on the floor. The fifth floor led to the roof. The tower was the tallest thing for miles and offered sweeping vistas of the desert. Dante only had eyes for the roof itself. A circle of black stone dominated the surface, 60 feet in diameter, and divided into 12 equal slices. As usual, sand dusted it all, but he immediately understood what it referenced, the 12 gods of the Seleucid. A far smaller circle was inscribed in the center. Each of its foot-long wedges was carved with an icon, the twin rivers of Aron, the Hound of Menoc, the anvil, the maiden. Some of the symbols didn't match what he was accustomed to, but what struck him was that there were 12, same as in Malin and Gask. Here in Westley, however, they worshipped the 13 lords of the Broken Circle. The slices were filled with regal glyphs. Some were clogged with sand, others wind-worn. but he thought they'd be able to read them. He moved to the edge of the tower and hollered down at Lu until the monk agreed to join him on the roof. They set to work copying the glyphs. Somber assisted. C slipped away. Ast stood on the roof and watched the desert. As the sun climbed, the air warmed enough for Dante to shed his cloak. The translations weren't easy business. The glyphs stood for syllables rather than letters, and the Morivese grammar was crude. They'd had time to familiarize themselves with the speech of the lost during the walk from Ellen, though, and it turned out the words in the circle were familiar, paraphrased lines from the Cycle of Aron. But Dante had found something outside the black circle, near a corner of the roof. Other glyphs had been hammered into the rock. They were sloppy, out of line, shallower than the orderly symbols chiseled into the cellarset. Dante called Lu over to help. Within an hour, they had several interpretations of the line. It was something close to, "The stone has broken and brought the skies down with it." They consulted with Ast, who confirmed their translation. "Does that mean anything to you?" Lu said.
"Sure," Dante said. "That I owe Horace a punch in the face for wasting our time."
"I don't know. It sounds portentous."
"What it sounds is vague. Have you checked the whole roof? The inside of the tower? Maybe there's more to see. Like a million acres of sand?" Dante folded his arms.
"I'll check inside again. Maybe I missed something."
Lou bobbed his head. "I'll get back to deciphering the walls." Dante went down to the fifth floor. This time he forced himself not to rush, using his torch stone to light the gloomier corners. But there was simply nothing to find, besides rubble and junk anyway. He circled through the rooms, sketching a quick layout, but there were no obvious walled-off spaces that might contain a hidden room. He walked down to the fourth floor and repeated his search. Midway through his sweep of the third, someone whistled from outside. He went to the eastern window and stuck his head into the daylight.
"Jump on down,"
C said from below, shielding her eyes with her hand.
"Or take the stairs if you prefer. Either way, you got to come take a look at this."
"What is it?" Dante said.
"Nope, you have to come see for yourself."
He clenched his teeth and headed down the stairs. On the ground floor, he hopped out the south window into the sand and headed over to sea.
There the sand dropped a couple feet, exposing the tower's foundation.
She beckoned him over and pointed to a rippled patch.
"Very good," Dante said. "You found more desert."
"Yeah, and it's all marked up with snake tracks."
"Snake tracks? These look exactly like the patterns of every dune here. Should I be fleeing for my life?"
"These tracks run the wrong way to be the wind," C pointed. "And there is no wind on this side. It's in the lee of the tower."
"The final reason you're wrong, these are shaped like snake tracks."
Dante glanced around.
"Okay. So what? Are you thinking of eating them?
Be my guest."
"Lou came by a few minutes ago. He said you hadn't found anything."
She pointed at the base of the wall.
"You checked in there?"
A small hole peeped from the wall. The sand around it had a lot of marks similar to the one C had found. Dante reached to scoop away the sand, thought better of it, and delved into the nether instead. Moving the sand turned out to be more difficult than he'd expected. It wasn't as sticky with itself as dirt or rock, but there were still shadows in it, even in this dry and lifeless place. Sand poured out of the hole. And kept pouring. The hole, initially large enough to admit a hungry mouse, expanded to the size of a plum, and then a fist. A sour, primal stink issued from within. Counter to his better instincts, Dante continued pulling sand away.
A couple feet underneath the wall, sunlight spilled onto a ball of tan ropes someone had coiled up and thrown away. In a horrible, scaly, living pile.
Gross!
Dante jumped back.
Are you trying to get me killed?
Think they're venomous? Even if they're not, I might shudder to death. She smirked. Look harder, brave leader. He crouched back toward the ball of sluggish snakes, extending the torch stone into the space. It shined on a bunch of sand and more snakes.
What am I supposed to be looking at? The physical manifestation of the world's nightmares?
Don't look what's in the hole. Look at the hole itself.
Why don't you save yourself from being strangled by me and—
He cut himself short.
The hole through the wall wasn't ragged or crumbled. It was a smooth line.
He brushed away the sand crusted at its top, revealing a pointed arch.
He was looking into a window,
one identical to the one he'd clambered through to get to the ground floor.
Rather, what he'd assumed to be the ground floor. The stairwell's completely plugged with sand. And there's more building below it.
He backed out, brushed off the dust, and ran to the window to the first floor.
Hey, Lou!
C shouted, still beside the hole. As Dante strode across the sandy floor to the stairs, Lou screamed bloody murder. The sand in the stairwell looked solid. It felt solid, too, even when Dante stepped and then jumped on the place where more stairs must have been hiding. He moved back to the entry and plunged his mind into the grains, using the nether inside them to assess their shape. It was solid all the way down to the next landing. Dante nicked his arm and focused. A snake of sand oozed from the stairs and slithered toward the window, growing wider as it went. Its head hit the wall, diverted upward, and felt its way through the window. The stream leaving the stairwell was now thicker than his waist. Several unearthed steps were visible below what he had taken to be the start of the stairs. Within minutes, he had an empty staircase and a great big pile of sand outside the window. He stood on the landing, gazing down into the darkness. Listening. Sniffing, too. The air wafting from below didn't just smell like dust. It smelled stale. And perhaps a little snaky. Basically, it smelled like the sort of place you should never willingly explore. Especially by yourself. Drawing his bone sword with his right hand, holding the torch stone in his left, and keeping the nether at the ready in his mind, he descended into the darkness. Stray grains gritted beneath his soles. The stairs were clear all the way to the bottom, where a makeshift wall of rotten wood, fabric, and ruined debris plugged the doorway. He cocked his sword and swung. Chunks of detritus hit the ground with brittle thuds. Sand slumped lazily through the hole, spilling over his boots. Inside, it rested thigh high, drifted deeper beneath the windows, which were cemented with sand. Nothing obvious stood out from the room. The stairs to the next level down were likewise clogged. He drew out the sand and piled it in the side of the basement. Every few seconds he glanced around himself, mistaking the hiss of the sand for that of angry snakes. The air on the next level smelled less sour and more stale. From that point on, the stairwell became clear enough to walk down. Sand still caked the windows and lay on the ground in little dunes, but in much lesser quantities than above. He continued down, floor by floor. On the ninth floor, counting down from the roof, timbers lay in heaps against the east wall. He touched one, and it crumbled into dry mulch. Rather than wood, it smelled like dust and age. Two floors lower, the doorway was stuffed with a plug of brick. He sent the nether into it and discovered it was dried mud. It took a moment to get it moving, but soon enough it flowed away into the room, adding to the layer cemented atop the floor.
This was thick enough that, when he stood on it, he could just touch the ceiling. He found a window and knocked on the ramp of clay that had dried within it.
It was as solid as the stone of the wall.
He circled around the floor, but it was a featureless mat of dried mud. The level below this was much the same, but it bore an open floor plan with taller windows, and the mud had filled it nearly floor to ceiling. In fact, guessing by the stains visible in the torchstone's wan glow, the mud had reached the ceiling, then retracted as it dried. He thought the air smelled like a riverbank after it's lost its flow, but that was impossible. This was the middle of the desert. The windows and the stairwell were clogged with branches and leaves. When he released them from the mud's hold, he smelled pine needles and sap. He cleared the way down to the next floor, the 13th below the roof. The stairs were twice as long as those leading to the other levels, but finally came to a stop. On this floor, he found no windows at all. As he sent the nether roaming through the hardened clay, he felt objects within it. These were mineral, too, and he could have moved them if he wished. But as he crawled into the mud floor, which lay less than 4 feet below the soaring ceiling, he saw the thin bones of arms jutting from the desiccated soil. The clay was embedded with skeletons. Scores of them. Mummified skin hung in flaps. The air tasted foul, yet stagnant, as if it hadn't stirred in decades. He began to feel light-headed. Panic surged through his nerves. He moved to the stairwell, the echo of his footsteps chasing him up the steps. A cool draft was working its way down the tunnel he'd dredged, and he paused 3 flights up from the mass grave, catching his breath, letting his pulse normalize. He might have been able to force himself to go back down, but he didn't. As he climbed back to what was now the ground floor, a silhouette peered down the stairs.
"Dante," Lou said, "where have you been?"
"Below."
"They checked the glyphs again, the ones you thought were written last. We were missing an accent on one of the words, the one for stone."
"So?" Dante said.
"So it doesn't really say the stone has broken and brought the skies down with it. In this instance, stone means a stone shaped for work, like a work table or a grinding stone."
Dante reached to the wall for support. "Or a millstone." Lou pushed out his lower lip. "That would fit. Get everyone onto the roof." Lou looked confused, but obeyed. Dante moved to the western edge of the tower. He had scraped his knuckles during his venture below, and the nether came quickly. He thrust his palm at the sand 50 feet below. A furrow appeared, grains tumbling down to refill it. The ground hissed like boiling water. Dust roiled into the air, billowing into a chaotic column that the western winds flung in their faces. Dante coughed and blinked, but continued to pour nether into the earth. When the dust settled, the others gaped at the crevice in the ground. "What in the name of my never-to-be-born son am I looking at?" C asked.
"Those look like trees," Somba said, "or things that might once have been trees before an angry god laid them to waste."
"Exactly," Dante said.
He sat down hard, suddenly more exhausted than he'd been since pulling a similar, though much larger, stunt inside the courtyard of the sealed citadel. On the ground, sand trickled down the edges of a crevasse that dropped 100 feet below the surface. The first 30 feet of the gap were nothing but sand and loose rock. For another 30 feet after that, the ground was everyday dirt. Below that, it was a solidified slurry of clay, and the branches, leaves, and trunks of a forest that had been destroyed and buried overnight.
"That's what we're after," Dante said. "That is the work of Selen."
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents The Cycle of Aron, The Complete Trilogy. Written by Edward W. Robertson. Read by Tim Gerard Reynolds. Chapter 26.
"You want to go see the king?" Min said. "Who may well be crazy, when we don't even know for sure that Selen's about to manifest. If there's any chance Modigan's about to get his hands on this thing, I have to stop him."
"What do you think he'd even do with it?
Explode Narashtovic? Summon a 50-mile chain and then summon every Norrin's ankles inside said chain? I don't know. I do know it won't be any good."
She watched the stars move on the water.
"If you go to Setevan, you won't be allowed back into the pocket."
"I know. I'm throwing it all away."
He ran his hand down his face.
"I don't want to go back to the world, but I think it might need a hand. Do you know why I left it?
Because you're smart and it's terrible?"
She laughed ruefully.
"When I was 15, I became pregnant. The circumstances were far from ideal. I decided to end it. I could have done it myself. I knew enough of the Nether to do that much, and more cleanly and peacefully than with the herbs other women use. But I made one mistake."
"You told your dad?"
Min nodded.
"He forbade me. Absolutely. He acted as if the child were his birthright. That I was just a bag. A satchel meant for carrying his grandchild. Disposable. He threatened to disown me if I did it. To make sure I didn't try, he locked me away."
"Has that ever worked to control a wanton daughter?"
"In my case, it was especially absurd, and cemented my resolve. I didn't have any tools, but I didn't need them. Within 5 minutes, I was finished, but I was in a bare room. A bed and some books. I couldn't hide it. When he saw, he threw me out, just like he'd threatened. Warned the rest of my family not to dare to help me. Not that they would have. Not after the lies he spread.
I wound up in Vos. Thanks to my skill with the shadows, I found better employment than most homeless young women. But they were still dark times. I don't know where it might have led if the people hadn't found me."
A buoy donged from the bay of Wending.
"Why are you telling me this?"
"Because I'm going to come with you."
"And you're trying to guilt me anyway?"
"Trying to understand why."
She turned toward Denny's manor.
"And to remind myself that if Ro decides I'm to be cast out of the pocket, I might have other family, after all."
He wasn't sure why she wanted to put her future in the pocket at risk. Maybe she'd spent long enough cooped up behind the cliffs. He didn't ask. His reasons were entirely selfish. She would be useful at Setevan. She could continue his training. And there existed the chance that, when he wrapped up this foolish mission, she might be able to get them both back into the pocket. That was a long shot, but it didn't matter. Mostly, he didn't speak up because he had no interest in telling anyone else what to do, or what not to do. It was too late to see Lolligan, so he went to sleep and got up as soon as he felt able. This was becoming increasingly difficult. He hadn't had a good night's sleep since leaving Pocket Cove, and the first hours of the day were growing harder and harder to face. He had a feeling it would be this way for a while. He rode to Lolligan's and they met in the cellar. Now that Cal had been removed from harm's way, Blaze felt freer to fill Lolligan in on the details, or anyway, those relating to his impending trip to Setevan. Lolligan quirked the corners of his mouth.
"You'd like to know what assets we have in the capital to assist you on your latest quest?"
"Am I that transparent?"
Blaze laughed.
"The answer is none. a couple of men-at-arms, nothing that would allow an enemy of the state to get his hands on the king's most treasured secrets. Then I'm on my own, except for the other person I've got with me. He cracked his knuckles. What about Taya? They know she was working with you. Her position's as precarious as yours. We were working to bring Modigan down. Now he's working to acquire the ultimate weapon. How can we let that happen?
Is it about that, Lolligan said, or is it about revenge?
If I were consumed by revenge, do you really think I'd have spent the last 3 months as a hermit at the end of the world? Blaze squeezed his eyes shut and pushed his palms against them. Anyway, if she wants nothing to do with this, do you really think I could force her? Lolligan chuckled.
Can't argue with that. She's holed up outside the capital. Good luck with the latest leg of your mad life.
He gave Blaze an address. Blaze rode back to Denny's. Denny informed him that the sloop was waiting to take him through the lakes and down the North Tail, the river that egressed from the northernmost edge of the lakes. From there, he could follow the forks of the river to Setevan, or use Denny's credit to buy a pair of horses and race straight there.
Thank you, Blaze said. I don't think we'll hear from Talavand again,
but until this blows over, you might want to hide the almanac somewhere very safe.
I thought you might want it, Denny said, to help understand what you're after.
Not a good idea, considering I'm about to deliver myself to the palace. Anyway, whatever Selen is, I don't care. I'm just here to stop the king from using it to commit any crimes, disasters, or atrocities.
Denny ran his finger down his graying sideburn. Maybe I should burn it. What good is its knowledge if it causes nothing but harm?
Start a rumor you sold it. To someone who lives far away, ideally somewhere hard to get to, like Carvajal's summer home on the glaciers of gnashing ice.
You know, I don't like the idea of destroying something that survived so long. I'll think of something.
The sloop was ready on the docks. He and Min boarded. From the pier, Denny and Cal waved. The sloop cast off and cut across the lake.
So, Blaze said, got any ideas?
Min's eyes shifted between his.
That's a real question. You do realize I've been out of the world for over 10 years, right?
There is that. On the other hand, you seem to know all about a thing I've never even heard of. Shit, I've never even heard Dante talk about this thing, and spooky and ethereal powers were all he ever talked about.
If the king's plans hinged on Talavand, there's a chance we've already dashed them. If not, it will likely involve his other sorcerers, the most powerful ones he's got.
The Endless Pillars, then. Blaze squinted against the light reflecting from the lake. I'm beginning to regret this decision.
Should I bother to point out we're still within sight of Wending, and there is nothing stopping us from going back to Pocket Cove?
Do you think this is such a bad idea?
The people believe the world will always choose to destroy itself, so it's best to get out of its way, Min said. But if we stuck to that advice, Cal might be dead.
Well, my dedication is reaffirmed, Blaze said. We'll be there in 3 days. Suppose I can learn to shadow walk before then?
Stretch our trip to 3 months and you might have a shot.
But it would make things a lot easier, wouldn't it? Let's give it a try.
Blaze bent to his task with fresh vigor. It was on the awkward side, practicing, and mostly failing, in front of the sloop's small crew, who had little to do besides keep an eye on the waters ahead and make the occasional adjustment to the sails. They pretended not to watch, but the ship was too small for Blaze to avoid their attention. Still, he and Min didn't have time for the luxury of discretion.
The Nether is everywhere, she said. Most of the time, however, even the few of us able to see it would never know it's there. It's concealed inside each grain of dirt and speck of blood. If you can follow it to those places, you'll be hidden too.
You want me to walk into my own blood? That sounds messy.
You can't walk anywhere you can't physically walk yourself. There are shadows in the air we walk through, though. All you have to do is climb inside. Sounds as easy as putting one foot in front of the other, Blaze said. How do you do it when you walk into the magical netherworld?
I try to think like water must think as it's flowing down a stream.
She saw his expression and laughed. Apply what you learned in the course of the four seasons. How do you learn to walk? One step at a time. He glanced across the sloop. The crew looked away, pretending to examine the clouds hanging over the peaks. He got out his kelivert shell and sat cross-legged on the deck. He did some breathing, then spent a while drawing out the nether and watching it recede back into the spaces between things. It did flow a lot like water, albeit a viscous type that you wouldn't want to drink. He came out of his fugue to find a couple hours had passed. He ate a pocket of bread stuffed with cheese and green onions, and went back to work. This time, instead of letting the nether flow away like rainwater into the ground, he tried to hang on to it. Not so much that it couldn't go back, but enough to slow its flow and stretch it out. He had the cockamamie idea that if he hung on with the perfect amount of strength, not too little, not too much, the nether would pull him in behind it. Probably this was his dumbest idea in a long line of dumb ideas. As always, however, a bad idea was better than no idea, so he stuck with it throughout the afternoon. The western peaks pulled down the sun and gobbled it up. The sloop slowed, approaching the channel into the northern lake. Cliffs rose from both sides. As the last of the light trickled from the sky, they crossed into the northern lake. After sundown, the wind went quiet, and the sloop flagged to a crawl. Scattered lights flickered on the shores. The cramped cabin held four hammocks. They took turns napping. Stars painted the sky and were reflected in the mirror of the lake. By dawn, they were halfway across it. The winds resumed, pushing them toward the channel that would take them out of Galador Rift. Blaze split his time among naps, attempts to follow the nether back into its hole, and thinking about how in the hell they were going to spy on the secluded world of the Endless Pillars if he couldn't learn how to shadow walk. A V-shaped cleft appeared in the crags ahead. The river flowed swiftly, the water's only exit from the lakelands. The crew took up places to guide the ship through the bends of the river's tumultuous descent from the highlands. As Blaze was hanging onto the nether, watching it ooze back into wherever it went to hide, the sloop dipped hard, making his stomach go floaty. His adrenaline surged. His focus became as sharp as chipped glass. His eyes widened. The world seemed to lurch closer, slowing down the same way it did during a sword fight. For a split second, everything went dark, yet he could still see. Certain objects, the crewmen, the trees on the shore, his hand, shined like moonlight on quicksilver. The light was oddly muted, though, like they'd look behind a pane of shadow-cut glass, like they used in the cathedrals of Bressel. The sloop floated on, unharmed by the rapids. After a couple of miles, the land flattened out and the currents calmed down. Try as he might, Blaze couldn't find his way back to that eerie land. He told what he'd seen to Min. Her eyebrows shot up. That's what I see. It's like walking through starlight. At the same time, it's like walking from a dazzling afternoon into a dark room. I did it, Blaze said, and I have no idea how. She suggested a number of exercises, but nothing got him back to that place of light and shadow. It felt like a breakthrough, though, and he'd had so few of those he nearly burst with hope. But the hope was frustration's favorite food. And as he tried and tried and failed, he began to resent that he'd tasted success in the first place. The day came to a close. The sloop pulled in to port at a medium-sized town. Denny had paid Blaze well, so he bought the crew room and board in an inn, where they'd have proper beds and food, before their return to Wending. In the morning, he purchased a pair of horses on Denny's letter of credit, along with several days of food and a couple sets of clothes. Nothing all that elegant, but he was still wearing the fancy, if weather-beaten, garb of Lord Pendulous. Where he was going, lighting himself on fire would attract less attention. Before departing, he asked about the roads into Setevan. Supposedly, the king's men had reduced their patrols in the last couple months, but despite that, the passage remained free of bandits. Even so, as he and Min rode north into the farmlands, Blaze kept a long eye down the road. When they reached the forest, he cut away from the rutted trail, walking his horse through the trees. After a few miles, they emerged onto more farms. The ground was clear, but the cold air threatened snow. They arrived in Setevan after dark. The main road passed through a sentried gate, but there was nothing to stop a person from entering through the single-family farms surrounding the city's southern approach. Blaze did just that. The city always smelled best in winter. Most of its most unpleasant substances were frozen in the gutters, and with few fresh vegetables on hand, people tended to bake copious amounts of bread. The scent of wood smoke was everywhere. It smelled even better after having been on the road. He knew the city well enough to find the ideal neighborhood for their stay, a place that was shady enough that no virtuous soul would ever visit it, yet not so down and dirty that they'd be in harm's way every time they stepped outside. He stabled the horses, and on inquiring with the stable boys, was able to find a room on the top floor of a row house. He paid 2 weeks' lodging in cash. Min gazed up at a spider that had occupied the upper corner of their room rent-free. "What's our next step?" "No idea," Blaze said. "Let's go lay eyes on the place and see if that makes us any smarter." It was still early evening, but the endless pillars were tucked into the hills behind the palace, and getting to them would take long enough that dark would conceal them soon enough. Blaze pulled up his hood and got a move on. He kept an eye out for unwanted attention. He had not one but two infamous identities to be recognized under, but it was dark. He was unkempt and coast-tanned, and the Setevites who could recognize a cleaned-up, well-lit version of himself were probably limited to 3 or 4 dozen. To be on the safe side, he took a path through the meaner quarters, aiming significant looks at any men who paid too much attention to the ostensible couple that was himself and Min. They crossed a bridge over the river and walked through a set of rolling hills. The row houses there were older but statelier than the one they'd found cheap lodgings in, and then the hills grew too steep for any houses at all. But not for a couple of fools who probably should have stayed by the sea and left the questing for those who still had a stake in the world. As they walked down a quiet street that dead-ended in a steep, grassy hill, Min passed beneath the shadow of a tree and vanished. With the Kelevert's help, Blaze shrouded himself in darkness. This had the less-than-ideal side effect of blinding him, but Min's hand found his. She led him through the frosted grass. The land climbed for a while, then began to descend. Min squeezed his hand. "Ought to be safe now." He let the shadow sphere drop away, blinking at the starlight. They were in a cleft between hills, hidden from the vast capital below. A series of hills and short cliffs stood before them. The next leg of their journey was less than half a mile as the crow flies, but it involved a great deal of climbing up and down. 3 times they had to backtrack when the way forward was too steep. An hour later, they crested a ridge. An ovoid valley lay below. The endless pillars were more than just a name. In the center of the valley, a circle of white pillars enclosed a lawn and a complex of stone buildings. Each pillar was as broad as a horse's chest, but some were knee-high stumps, while others stood 30 feet or more, with all heights in between. The central building was round and a good 60 feet high, with a flat roof and classically arched windows. The surrounding buildings had the simple elegance of older times. A few lanterns burned around the pillars and at points on the lawn, but they saw no one.
"Think you can sneak in?" Blaze said.
"Think they'll leave the door open?" Min said. "Before I were to get inside, I'd need to know exactly what to look for. Even then, if one of their sorcerers were paying attention, it would be easy enough to spot me."
Back when I used to hang around the palace, gossip often turned to the pillars. It's basically a self-contained village. Like all villages, rumors fly fast and furious within it. I hear the court sorcerers are treated like circus bears, cared for but kept in a cage, except when it's time to put on a show.
So, we won't be able to get inside. Or talk to them. Yeah, besides the king himself, they're the only ones who'll know about his plans toward Selin.
I hate to cast doubt before we've tried to lift the stone, but how are we supposed to get this done?
This is exactly why I continue to run short on ideas.
Min bit her lip.
I could join them.
Except that would be crazy. I'm not the pocket's biggest whale, but I bet I'd be the most promising student to come here in years. They won't be able to turn me down. Once I'm embedded with them, who knows what I'll see.
It was kind of an incredible idea. Much less roundabout and more effective than anything he was liable to come up with. He couldn't volunteer himself. Too much of a chance he'd be recognized. But Min would be an irresistible talent. It was a scheme right out of the old days. But that was the problem. Back then, they'd always been so eager to get what they wanted, they'd given no regard to the cost.
"You can't," he said. "Once you're in, they won't let you back out."
"Who's going to stop me?"
"The staff," he blurted.
Min muffled her laughter.
"What are they going to do, cross their rakes in front of me?"
"When I decide to leave, they won't even be able to see me."
"In any institution, the staff always knows more about what's going on than its own leaders. This makes the help bitter, and that makes them susceptible to bribes. Sometimes they'll spill their guts out of sheer spite."
She looked down on the grounds.
"Do the staff get to leave?"
"They work in shifts. 2 weeks here, 2 weeks home with their families, something like that. I talked to one at a ball once."
"Do you really think the servants are going to know what exactly? The precise curve in the king's intestines where he's pocketed the golden key?"
"Well, we won't know that until we kidnap and torture them."
He couldn't stop his smile. "We will inquire discreetly, misrepresenting our interests. If that doesn't work, we'll try your plan to voluntarily imprison yourself."
Getting a line on the Endless Pillar's servants proved harder than he would have believed. The first time Min asked a man if he knew any of them, Blaze was trying to keep his direct contact with people to a minimum. The man behind the bar asked why she wanted to know, and when she hesitated, he showed her straight to the door.
"New approach," Blaze said. "You're looking for employment at the Pillars. You yearn to be part of such a glorious institution. You know they're beyond selective with their employment, so you're looking for someone who can grease the skids by providing you with an introduction."
"We can sweeten the deal by claiming that if I'm hired due to their introduction, I'll pay them 10% of my first year's wages."
"That is devious business," Blaze laughed. "That's why it'll get results." An hour and three pubs later, her bait caught a strike.
One of the runners had a friend whose sister worked at the Pillars. Better yet, she was currently on leave with her family. After exchanging a few notes and settling on a sum for the woman's time, the runner arranged a meet in the pub for that same night.
"Ever done something like this before?" Blaze said once they'd returned to their apartment.
"What?"
Min held at arm's length the long-sleeved shirt they'd bought to make her look the part. "Lie to someone about my intentions in order to learn whether the ancient order of sorcerers that employs them is on the verge of capturing an item of unspeakable power?"
"Asking about something you don't care about while trying to extract information about the thing you do care about. I suppose that's a daft question, isn't it? We all do that every day."
"I've never done it professionally, though.
You'll be there to chaperone me, won't you?
That was the